And so I sat there and I tried to figure out how I was going to write this. And then I realized why am I writing this though? I'm writing this because I'm trying to say all the things I wasn't allowed to say or didn't feel safe saying or didn't feel comfortable saying.
Welcome to the Book Coach Chronicles, a podcast for writers of books, people who want to be writers of books, and y'all in the back who've been thinking about it but don't yet consider yourself a writer. We chat about all things authorhood, from the creative process and making your writing life easy and enjoyable to actually getting your book out into the world and the power it has to change it. I'm your host, Holly Ostrout, and together we're going to bring creativity, sustainability, and delight to writing your book. So let's make this year the season of your book. Welcome back. Today I'm really excited to talk to Suzanne Yateem Aslam. Suzanne is a former actress and Miss Arab USA turned writer. Her dark comedy, Post Pardon Me, is now an Amazon bestseller and a reader's favorite with 5 stars. She's on a mission to help mamas feel supported in one of the most confusing times of their lives. Suzanne, welcome.
Thank you, Holly. I'm excited to talk to you.
I am really excited to talk to you too. When we first connected, we talked about our experiences a little bit. We didn't go into too much detail, and I'd love to do that here about our experiences after having our first baby. So you experienced postpartum depression and I experienced postpartum anxiety, which I didn't even know was a thing. I had never heard of before I had a baby. And what I found out after having her 5 years ago was that things that you would think would be really common knowledge among mothers and doctors and society in general are not talked about. And there's got to be a reason for that. Would you like to talk about that?
It's one of those things where like, I wish I didn't have to write my book, you know, because people wouldn't. They're like, what's the point? We know everything. It's fine. But it's not. It's so there's a very specific script that we run with mothers, particularly parents in general, but mothers in particular, about how you're supposed to feel. A child is a blessing. And if you feel anything other than gratitude for that child, then you are a terrible mother. And it's something that we just innately feel because of the expectations we put on ourselves and the assumption that we are born with the like biological understanding of how to mother. That coupled with the fact that people see us sort of as like a Virgin Mary, like the Madonna, just this like one note individual rather than a person who's very dynamic with an extensive array of emotions. And those emotions get intensified during that time. We feel things that most people don't experience, or maybe perhaps in a truncated timeline because the onset of motherhood so instantaneously. So we're in a lot of ways we're not allowed to be dynamic. And we put that upon ourselves and we allow other people to put that upon us. And it's not something that we've really broken from. So when we have feelings that go against that, we shame ourselves for it.
Mm-hmm. Shame was a huge part of my early motherhood months because it seemed like everything was going wrong. My baby wouldn't latch, didn't have enough milk. I was having intrusive thoughts and I wanted to be creative and work and I couldn't. And I also wanted to be with my baby all the time and I couldn't do that either. So I felt like pulled in so many different directions with no support. And that definitely created a sense of isolation in me, which I think is really counter to what mothers are supposed to feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the isolation thing is pretty common. We do it to ourselves, but it's sort of an expected response because you don't feel comfortable going, oh my God, this is crazy. I can't do this. The only response that you have is to just shut up and go inward. So it's a common practice that we have. And it's really not fair. But to your point, we as mothers, I mean, we're supposed to have that, you know, they say what's the phrase? It takes a village to raise a child. Well, I firmly believe that village is for you and me. I mean, the kids, like we have to take care of the caretaker. So we're going to take care of the baby. That's what we do. And we're going to figure that out, but who's taking care of us? And that's where we need our tribe. And we're not really, especially in this country, we're not very good at having a tribe.
That's such an important point that you make, that the village should be for us as the mothers. Mm-hmm. Is there something that you found in your process of when you wrote your book of how mothers can create that village for themselves?
So funny. The point of my book was twofold. It was one to be like, hey, I understand you. Like, let me hold your hand while we walk through this together. Because I mean, people have read my book and they're like, oh, you could take out your name and put in mine. And that's my story. So this is very common. I'm not special here. So the idea of feeling like you're not alone in this is really, really great. But secondly, it's also I'm trying to give you the courage to ask for help because you're the one that has to do it. Somebody else isn't going to come and be like, I'm going to just do this all for you and take care of it unless you advocate for yourself. Then other people can step in and be like, okay, how can I help you? And let me take this off of your plate. But until you actually say, I need help, I'm not okay, this is too much, people are just going to assume, because we see women as this mothers as this one note individual, in that one note being, I'm just this perfect, pristine mother, that you've got this. So asking for help is really, really hard. And sort of demanding that village is really, really hard. And it sucks because I'm giving you work. I'm saying, hey, like, you have to go and find it. Okay, off you go. Like, that's a really big ask. I get that. But without it, we're humans are not solitary creatures. We're communal. And I think we forget that. And we forget that with the moms, particularly because she locks herself in her room to nurse the baby. Now she's like away in the corner by herself because we're ashamed of our bodies and we're sexualized at the same time. And it's just so horrific that we don't feel safe. So we have to go into a corner and hide while everybody else is getting together. We're off in the corner alone. And that symbolism says a lot. So you have to do it yourself, which, sorry.
As with anything though, you have to take the steps if you want the experience to change. But you're right that it is almost an impossible position to be in. Mm-hmm. You, as you said, are sexualized, you're isolated because they don't want you to be sexualized, but you have to feed your baby and things like that. It is very impossible to navigate for many first-time mothers and even second, third-time mothers, because it doesn't change. We're kind of competing with our internal needs and what society expects of us, which are completely different things. And I know that you've also worked as an actress before. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how your experience working as an actress has influenced the way that you maybe responded to some of these things.
To just postpartum depression?
And the village and the society's expectations and all of it.
Well, it's so interesting because I was an actor, I kind of viewed life through the lens of film. So for example, I had a scare when I was about 10 weeks with my first son. And, you know, it was like really awful pain and I thought I was having a miscarriage. And on the drive to the hospital, it was a long drive. It was like 30 minutes. My pain started to go away. And I was like, did it go away because I lost the baby and like that's done now? Or was it just a false alarm and I was in pain and now I'm no longer in pain? And I didn't know. And I caught myself thinking, okay, if I lost the baby, how am I supposed to react to this? Like, what is the appropriate response? And then I realized that I have created, and I don't think it's just me as an actress. I think we do this through because of media. I have created an amalgamation of like every single movie or TV show I've seen where somebody has a miscarriage, because their response is always the same. Like they fall to the floor and they cry and they grieve and all this stuff. But I, at that point, did not feel very connected to the baby, which it was also kind of concerning. But I was like, oh, but I don't know if I would do that. No, but I'm supposed to do that because that's the script. That's the story. That is the only route you can take, is you have to do the whole devastated thing. And I just didn't know if I was actually going to be devastated. And I tussled with that on the drive and just realized, oh my God, I'm trying to have a response and not a real one. I'm trying to have a response based on how I expect this to go, because we've seen movies where life events occur. Like, nobody actually, when their water breaks, do they rush to the hospital and all their friends go with them? That's not a thing. But I didn't know that wasn't a thing. I had no idea. I thought, like, as soon as your water breaks, you go immediately, the baby's on its way. You know, that's not true, but that's how the movies showed us. So I just really, really lived my life through that lens. And it was quite an awakening after having kids to realize this was like the most real time in my life. And it really is nothing like the idealized life that I like to live through film.
That's a really interesting thing to notice about that. It must have been kind of jarring to come from a film background and realize that nothing is really like the films, almost like you had to put on a performance in order to have a baby. And I think that is something that a lot of women feel in many areas of their lives. I work a lot with creative entrepreneurs, and they often feel like they have to put on a performance just to run a business. And they often feel like there is a script to follow. And if they're not following the script, they're doing it wrong. But that's not the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not the case. But that's, doing things differently is scary. What if I didn't cry? What if I did miscarry and I didn't cry? That makes me a bad person. Do I want to be a bad person? Do I want you to think that I'm just this monster who doesn't have any feelings towards my child? And, you know, and then like all that goes with it. So I'm assuming you're going to shame me and judge me. So I'm just going to go ahead and do it myself. Yeah.
Oh gosh. I'm assuming you're going to shame me and judge me. So I'm just going to do it myself. That is such a common response in so many people that I meet. Something that we probably need to work on as a society to not do, because there will always be somebody who looks at you and says, you know, I know more about your business than you do, and I'm going to judge you for it. But it's so much smaller as a ratio than you would you think, than you make yourself believe.
Yeah. And like, for example, the Miss Arab thing, when I won, lots of support, lots of love. It was great. But, you know, you have some trolls, and I let those trolls be the ones to ruin it for me. They ruined it for me. Like, I had 2 days where I felt really great. And then I got onto social media and they were saying really horrible things about me, and that deflated me. And I don't even know who they are. They're just people on the internet. They're faceless, nameless, vile human beings. And I let them have so much power and take away all of my joy from that experience. But that was my fault. I did that. But it's almost like you just expect it. It's weird.
It is. And I think we've all experienced trolls, and there is, and there's so much advice on how to deal with the trolls. And yet when we actually experience our own trolls, it feels very difficult to actually put that into practice. Something you mentioned earlier really stuck out to me. You talked about going inward on that journey to motherhood. And I wonder how this practice of going inward, how you may have applied this in other areas of your life as well, and what you learned from going inward. So would you like to talk about that for a few moments?
Hey friends, I hope you're enjoying the show. If you're ready to write your book and you're looking for tools, resources, or a little extra support, you can find all of that at booksandalchemy.com, where you can grab my free writing ritual creator, join one of my super special memberships, or schedule a chat to talk about book coaching. Again, it's all at booksandalchemy.com. Oh, and be sure to subscribe to the podcast. Like, go ahead and do it now. And now, back to the show.
Well, when we talked about going inward, it was, I think we were saying, like, I couldn't talk about it to the outside world, so I just went in, and in an isolated fashion, right? So there are really terrible things about that, but you can use it to your advantage if you choose to. I don't think we always do that well, and I don't think that I'm a shining example of doing that. But when you're having, especially creative people, if you're having those really big feelings and you feel really alone, it's actually a really interesting time to process it and write it all down and kind of look at it from an observer perspective. Because think about, like, do you know, like, if I had to write my book now, my kids are 8 and 6, but if I had to, like, put myself in that state of postpartum depression now, it would be really hard. I mean, I could probably get there if I, like, played the right music and, you know, looked at photos of my kids when they were little and, like, remember that time. But if I were, like, I'm going through, like, a really hard time right now with some family stuff, and I'm writing down what I'm experiencing with that family stuff in a way that it's so fresh, but I'm also looking at it, like, in one way, I'm sitting in it and I'm feeling it, but then at the same time, I can also look at it from, like, an observation deck, is what I've been calling it. And when you're looking at it from the observation deck, it's just such an interesting connection, because you're looking at you, but you're also you, if that makes sense. Have you ever read The Untethered Soul?
No. What's that about?
It's a really interesting book. I feel like I have it somewhere behind me. It's a really good book that explains how your thoughts are not you. So one of the things I talk about with postpartum depression, when I tell mamas, I'm like, listen, if there's one thing from this podcast that you take away, your depression is lying to you. But you're like, well, how can that be? Because those are my own thoughts, but they're not. So like there's you, and then there's the you that's watching you, and that's all happening in your head, right? So going inward and like experiencing those thoughts and being able to like live in that and feel it and really understand and allow that to stem your creativity. The way I think your creativity gets stemmed is when you're the observer. So like you can feel it in one sense, but then like observe it so you can actually like pull it apart and write it down and assess how it's kind of coming about. Does that make sense?
Yeah. It actually reminds me of NLP, neuro-linguistic programming. Have you heard of it?
No.
I don't know quite how to explain it because I'm certainly no master NLP practitioner, but I have used it to really good effect. And in NLP, one of the exercises that you can do, I think it might be the most famous one from NLP, is looking at the movie screen of an event or a fear or a phobia, for example. Mm-hmm. And you kind of picture yourself in a movie theater. You're watching a screen, this image in your head playing mm-hmm. over and over. And it could be something that has happened that you have trauma over, or it could be something that you are just catastrophizing in your head. Mm-hmm. And you see it, and then you kind of pull yourself back and you look at yourself watching it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so you're observing the observer, and then you watch the screen get smaller and smaller. And it does actually help the emotion around such kind of events or fears or past traumas kind of disappear. It helps it just minimize it until it's not really something that you feel anymore. That's really interesting that you use that as well. And I liked what you said about your depression is lying to you.
Yes. That is not you.
That is really interesting. And I bet it applies for your anxiety is lying to you too.
Oh, 100%. Oh my God. Yeah. Because all anxiety is fear of the future, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like this thing that hasn't happened, but you're convinced it's going to happen. And so you just like start spinning this web. And it's so sickening, like really sickening, like in your stomach, you feel like you're going to throw up all the time, right? Yeah. And so you're just like, you're just writing scripts over here, just telling yourself all sorts of tales. You're just spinning tales. And that's all lies. But it just like, okay, depression and anxiety are beasts. They are very, very real things. But it's so interesting how difficult it is to get out of it. Because once your body becomes familiar with something, it likes it. So even if it's something bad, it still likes it because your brain is meant to survive, not thrive, is what they say. So you need something. Your brain likes comfort. So if depression is comfortable or anxiety, like constantly thinking about this is comfortable, then you're just going to keep doing it because your body's like, oh, I need something familiar. This is good. And so that cycle just becomes so, so vicious.
Yeah. Habits are safe to your brain.
Yes. Yes. Oh, I'm going to write that down. I like that. Habits are safe.
Yeah. So I want to transition a little bit and talk to you about your book and the writing process that you went through. I know that when you spoke earlier about the process for writing and you know, you're going through some experiences with your family right now, some hard times, but if you tried to get into writing your book about postpartum now, it would be more difficult because you're not in that space right now, which I'm very glad for. I'm glad you're not in the space right now, but also grateful that you were able to use that space when you were in it productively and create something that's going to be and has been helpful for so many women experiencing the same things. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about how you were able to work through those experiences to be creative enough to put that together?
So when I wrote it, I had just gotten out of it. And I remember being really angry. I was really angry that I felt lied to, you know, by other mamas who acted like everything was fine or just wanted to put on this show. Even small stuff like people are like, oh, you won't get your period if you're nursing. Well, that's just a big fat lie. Like, why are we telling each other this? It happened to one lady one time. And now that's just like, that's the thing. So I just remember being just so angry. And I finally got out of it. And I was like, why did it take me? Because it was 4 years between being my first kid and then coming out of it with my second kid. So yeah, it's a lot. So I remember just being really angry and then not being able to act. It was really hard to do film or commercials or whatever with the kids. And so now I'm like, I need a creative outlet. And I'm really angry. So I started writing. And I had been writing scripts with my husband before this. So I knew how to, like, you know, how to write in that way. But when I sat down to write the story, I was like, well, it's not going to be a script. It's going to be a book, which screwed things up for me because I just started writing and I wrote 30 pages and it was so vile. It was just awful. It was just so, ugh, it was so gross. So, and if anybody's never written a book and they want to write and they're starting to write and they're like, this is disgusting, good. Get it all out. Like, get rid of all of the disgusting. But if it stays in your head, it's just, you're never going to get anywhere. So I was 30, it was 30 pages and it was all I could think of. Like, I wrote everything and I was done in 30 pages. And I was like, well, this is a pamphlet and not a very good one. And so I sat there and I tried to figure out how I was going to write this. And then I realized why am I writing this though? I'm writing this because I'm trying to say all the things I wasn't allowed to say or didn't feel safe saying or didn't feel comfortable saying. What is the best format for that? Journal entries. If I let you inside of my head, if I gave you my journal right now and was like, here, read this, that would be the safest place, right? Your journal is your safest place to actually say how you really feel. So these are made up journal entries that I created. So I got to use my creativity in that way and like my anger fueling that creativity to create these stories. So there's dialogue in it, which is so much fun for me. I love writing dialogue. What I did is I was like, okay, well, if there's journal entries, that means like, I have to say, okay, here's what happened today. Right. And then you like reflect on what you were feeling that day. So I went back through my first year with my son, Sammy, and I looked at our calendar and I just went through the calendar from 2015. And I was like, okay, oh yeah, I had that event that one day. And then I reflected on that event and what I was feeling. And I remember being really mad that I met a pregnant woman and she was so happy. And I was so mad at her for getting pregnant because she was the coolest girl I know. And she just ruined her life by getting pregnant. Is she crazy? And I remember being like just illogically furious with this dumb dummy for getting pregnant and being joyful about it. And so even just sort of like going through that timeline helped sort of spur those, it helped just kind of bring me back to those moments that otherwise, if I just sat there in a silo by myself, would have been a bit difficult to do.
That's so interesting that you said that you use your calendar to go back. That's a really excellent method. A lot of memoirists use that method as well. And I also like what you said about using your anger to fuel your creativity, because we often think of anger as such a negative emotion, but it's a neutral emotion. It's what you do with your anger that makes it negative or positive. And using your anger to write this book clearly was a much more positive outlet for your anger than you know, many other options you could have taken.
Yeah. Anger is a, what do they call it? They call it secondary emotion. Anger being the easier pill to swallow, because it's so much easier to be angry than like heartbroken. If somebody breaks up with you, you're really sad. Well, then that's immediately, what do we go? Well, you know, he's a piece of garbage anyway. Who cares? Like, we immediately want to go to that because that's so much safer. So what's the backstory behind the anger is such an interesting thing. Like, I felt lonely. I felt confused. I felt betrayed by people who told me that motherhood was wonderful. And then I felt like it wasn't. And so there's just all these like other emotions, and it's just so nicely wrapped inside of anger. And it's just such an easier, it's just so safe. It's so safe to be angry. Yeah.
I also had plenty of mothers who made me think that pregnancy and motherhood was going to be very different from what it was. And it's almost like some of us feel obligated to kind of continue the ruse.
Yes.
I didn't get going here. I certainly didn't lose the weight from breastfeeding. And I was so sick for so long. Couldn't even walk the last 10 weeks of my pregnancy. My hips were hurting so badly. And that is not an exaggeration. That is literal. So yeah, my experience is for nothing like what's in TV or what's in the films.
Yeah. But then we have to preface it or by saying like, I love my baby, but he's driving me crazy. Like, we have to just, because otherwise, am I going to assume you don't love your baby? You know, like, that we have to always shroud it in what we expect you to, the other person to what we expect them to expect us to say.
I wish we could just all assume that everybody loves their babies.
Yeah. I mean, I think that is the assumption. So why do we walk around assuming that that's not, it doesn't make any sense.
We're putting the pressures of assumed shame on ourselves before anybody else puts it on us.
Mm-hmm. Assumed shame. Mm.
Yeah. So I would like to ask you to share one tip that you would share with anybody else who was trying to write a book.
Know your audience. That's a really good one. If I was writing it for me, then I would just write it in my journal and just call it a day. But I'm not writing it for me. I'm writing it for mamas. So as much as it's really important to be authentic and say, you know, what you want to say and be you, you have to be crafty with it and angle it in a way that, like, I can't have inside jokes, essentially, you know, like things that only pertain to me. That just doesn't work. So really, really knowing your audience is really important. We used to do this thing in a scene study class where you'd have a script and like you're just like looking at a page of dialogue. And then each dialogue, you go, okay, what is the actual meaning behind what this line means? So somebody would say, I'm just so angry right now. And then what they're saying, and then in parentheses, like, you know, you're studying the character and you're like, okay, really what she means is I feel alone. I have no one to talk to. And so each line, and they would always tell us this, they're like, the writer put that line in there specifically. The writer didn't make a mistake. That's not a throwaway line. Like each line is so, so valuable. So what does this all mean? And what is it that they're really trying to say? And so I felt like that really applied to writing my book, because I needed each line to carry the weight that I wanted it to carry. So the person on the other end of the book could feel what it was that I was trying to get them to feel. That's why you have to really know your audience.
Audience is one of the things that will sink a book faster than anything else. And it's when I work with clients, it is one of the very first things we work on before we start planning out chapters.
Really?
Before you start writing any chapters or any paragraphs or anything, it is one of the very first things you have to nail down. Because if you don't know who you're writing to, then you don't know how to talk to them.
Okay. You see how amazing that was? That was just like, I just said that off the top of my head. And the fact that that's what you, the first thing that you tell people, are you listening, everyone? This is apparently really important. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's why I remember when I was doing my book, I was like trying to get my book out there. They're like, who is it written for? And you want to say like, oh, anybody would enjoy this, because you're trying to get like as many people to like it as possible. And I remember people being like, that's the worst thing that you can say. It's better to be like from the ages like 20, women 25 to 40, or, you know, whatever it is, young dads, because dads read my book too. Yeah, it helps them get inside the head of the lady that they think is now crazy.
That's funny. Yeah. Yeah. My husband definitely put up with a lot for me. And
yeah, give him my book.
Fortunately, I don't have a postpartum anxiety anymore, but I'm definitely going to be giving it to other people, because I do have some acquaintances and friends who are pregnant right now. And I think that we're afraid to say anything. We're afraid to ask. So give the book to your pregnant friends before they need it. And with that in mind, where can everybody find you online?
I live on Instagram. Mm-hmm. Oh, my book is on Amazon. It's called Postpartum Me. And you can always contact me via Instagram. It's the only place I live. Don't make me go to any other apps, please. That's it.
Okay, well, we will put your Instagram handle in the show notes, and we'll put a link to your book in the show notes as well.
Awesome.
And I like to ask everybody, if you're comfortable, what one thing you're grateful for this week.
So you asked me this before we started rolling, and I was like, God, I need to think about this. And I realized I'm grateful for strangers. I have met the most interesting people in the last month or two. I've sort of let myself be a little bit more open, but I'm a writer and I'm whatever I am. And so I'm really good at being like, you know, sort of I'm looking for, like brooding. Like I can easily brood and be like, nobody understands me. And, you know, and so I've recently sort of pulled myself out of that sort of like nihilistic place I was hanging out in. And when I did that, I started meeting the most interesting people and connecting with people in ways that I never allowed myself before. And those strangers are becoming not strangers. And it's just been such a gift that the universe has sought fit to bestow upon me. I decided to be a little bit more open and I was rewarded for it. So strangers.
I love that. That is definitely a unique gratitude response. Oh, nice. And it may be my favorite so far.
Aw, that makes me happy.
Fun. Well, thank you so much for coming on to chat with me today, Suzanne.
Thanks, Holly. It was fun talking to you.
Thank you so much for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. And if you're feeling like it's a good day for good karma, please take a moment to leave a quick review. It tells the robots that my existence matters. And according to all the personality typing systems, external validation sustains me. So have the best day and write that book.